Hello, Les Raymond here with the Mindful Movement. Whether you are about to enjoy one of Sarah's beautiful meditations or dive into a podcast interview, I would like to remind our community that the best way to support the Mindful Movement is to support the companies that make this happen. Sarah and I are very picky about the companies we choose to work with, and we are grateful to have the relationships we have and to share them with our listeners. You can learn more about our affiliates through our website by clicking on the Favorites tab. We are excited to have recently added Sun Lighten as an affiliate. They make state-of-the-art infrared saunas, and their founder, Connie, came on for a recent interview if you would like to listen. Our Sun Lighten sauna has been a family favorite for over a decade. Some of our most popular affiliates are the Grounding Mats from Ultimate Longevity, which we sleep on every night, and the Apollo Neuro, which Sarah is now wearing daily to help manage stress. When you support these brands, you in turn are supporting the Mindful Movement and helping Sarah and I continue to devote our time to this passion. Whether you check out these companies or not, I just want to say thanks again and reiterate how grateful Sarah and I both are for all of the support over the years. I hope you enjoy the episode.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Mindful Movement Podcast. I'm your host, Les Raymond. Thanks for joining me today for another episode. I'll apologize up front for the noise in the background. It's cicada season here on the East Coast, so we have some strange background noise going on. It's been a fascinating process watching these little bugs kind of take over the community. So today I have a guest. Her name is Rebecca Strong. She is a therapist and a yoga teacher, and she helps folks work through trauma by regulating the nervous system. And I guess really through some talk therapy leading up to tapping into how the brain works and how it regulates our nervous system, and then trying to use that mechanism to our advantage, as opposed to our nervous system kind of getting hijacked by these very elegant systems that we have to help regulate stress. I have to tell you, this conversation took a very unexpected turn. I did not think going into it that I was going to open up some of my own childhood trauma, and somehow the conversation just eased into that. I don't know what it was about Rebecca's message or that it resonated with me the way it did, but I felt invited to open up. Didn't really plan for it. This conversation was yesterday. I gotta tell you, I felt like it has been a very important conversation for me in my life. Since the conversation, which was just yesterday, I've really felt good. It's been interesting to notice how good I felt since airing out some of my stuff that I deal with, some of my suffering. I said some things in the conversation that not only did I not expect to say, they're not things I've shared with many people in my life. I could probably count on two fingers. So I gotta say, I got a little vulnerable, didn't expect it, and it turned out to be really valuable for me personally. A little nervous about releasing this conversation because I did get so personal, but I hope that it also resonates with some of the listeners, and maybe it could help you when navigating your own journey and kind of managing your own suffering and whatever you may have kind of harbored in the body from your past. That being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Thanks for tuning in. Hello, everyone. I have Rebecca Strong here coming in from Boulder, Colorado. Rebecca, thank you for joining us on the Mindful Movement Podcast. Mm-hmm. Say hello to the audience.
Absolutely. Good morning, everyone. And thank you, Les. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. So, Rebecca, you're a clinical licensed professional counselor.
Yes. Registered yoga teacher and a EMDR specialist or therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And we were put in contact through Laura Brazil, which if the listeners remember, she was on the podcast several months ago. She's an old colleague of mine that now, I guess, runs an organization that really relies on the activity of walking to help as like almost a meditation practice or healing practice and a movement practice kind of all lumped up in one. And looking forward to having her back on the podcast one day. But she, I guess, knew you somehow and thought we should get in touch. And I was kind of excited because I've heard about EMDR and I'm very curious. And I've been doing all kinds of weird stuff with my eyes over the last year or so.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I've just dipped my toe into trying to interact with my nervous system through my eyes.
Mm.
So I'm looking to learn more and hoping you could shed some light and give us some context around those ideas. But I guess first, how'd you even get into this?
Sure. Well, I think in my early 20s, I traveled overseas. I lived about 4 years overseas, and I got really curious about people and how people from different cultures, how we were the same and how we were different. And so human perception became very interesting to me. And how we perceive circumstances can determine a lot about how we show up or what we do, you know, can kind of influence behavior. So I've always been a curious person about nature and people, and I wanted to understand more about people, about the human brain, about the nervous system. And I also have been studying yoga. I was given my first yoga mat when I was in my early 20s. And that experience of going from sort of an outwardly focused perception to learning to turn my perception toward the inner game and the internal world was such a gateway moment for me of, you know, the first time I did child's pose on my own yoga mat, like, wow, I've got my own little lily pad here in the pond. And I can actually turn the light of my own consciousness inward. And learning to track the breath was such an anchoring and liberating experience. Like, oh, this is a companion. You know, immediately, I'm going to refer to the breath as she. I think my yoga teacher sort of turned me on to that, and it just works for me. It's, it's like this companion that allows my own perception, right, to deepen into what's happening on the inside and that freedom, that became a freedom for me and like an endless source of delight and curiosity, both during the difficult times and the good times. So I think my training in experience in yoga later, I wanted to apply sort of the science I was learning of the body, both the physical sciences, but also the, you know, anatomy, physiology, but also like, what is this connection between the brain, the body, and the breath? And when I became a clinician, I wanted a more scientific approach to therapy because I had experienced myself like years of talk therapy that didn't really gain enough traction for the amount of time I put in. It didn't really get me an ROI, the ROI I was looking for. And I thought there's gotta be a path towards mental health. And I actually call it mental fitness and mental hygiene that's more science kind of based and has ways of kind of intending greater results and getting greater results. And when I found EMDR, it kind of bridged the link between the physical arts of dance. I have a background in embodiment and dance, as well as yoga and martial arts. I studied Aikido in Japan. So EMDR has given me that bridge between the body and the mind.
Cool.
Yeah. So
there's a couple of things you said there that resonated with me. You referred to your breath as a companion.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. And I spend a lot of time on the mat myself, try to get on the mat every day. And
beautiful.
It's like this moment where you go from, as I've heard it, like kind of working out to working in, this inward thing. And that's interesting. Like there's always this moment where it's like, ah, we're here again. Like,
yes.
And as if there is a companion that you're with. That's a very, that word really resonates with me with that. Because I've never tried to really articulate the sensation that arises when I close the door behind me and I stand on the mat. I kind of look it up and down. I get in where I want to position. And then it's like, we're here again. Time to begin.
Yes.
And it's like, you have a, even you're by yourself, but you're not, you do have a companion.
Yeah. Right. And she's always there. It's like a best friend who's always waiting for us to turn and say hi. Yeah. Like she's like, I've been here all morning. You're just showing up.
Yeah. It's right? funny too. It makes me think I've been sober for, well, no, I wouldn't say sober, sober from drinking for a while. And
congratulations.
Thank you. So when it was like 100 days sober, I made this post on Facebook about, you know, whatever came to my mind that day about it. And so you know how Facebook does those like memories? So yesterday was like 5 years and 100 days. So I had this thing come up reminding me of my 100-day post that I did 5 years earlier. And it's interesting because I can relate that too. I remember looking at his alcohol as a companion. It was like, my friend.
Oh my gosh. Like, yes.
Cause that's the way I would like soothe. Like I could be coming home from work and like, I knew like no matter what kind of day, like I was going to be able to pour a drink and sit with it and have my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like now, it's like, oh, my going inward is, I'm my own best friend and I have this breath as a companion.
Yes, yes. I love that you said that about, thank you for your vulnerability, first of all, to share that memory and how you thought of that drink or alcohol, right? And it sparked something in my own brain around anxiety and depression, right? So one of the tools that yoga has brought to me as a mental health, as a professional, licensed professional counselor is like the title. But when you look at mental health through the lens of the nervous system, we've got these three layers. I actually have this little chart here that comes from, that originally, sorry, the lighting's a little off, but this comes from St. Michael's in Toronto, but it's the window of tolerance. So Dan Siegel, Pat Ogden originally came up with this chart. I love it because it's like the Earthrise, the first time that the astronauts turned the camera back to the planet. And we were able to have a picture of the Earth for the first time. It was that 1967. So it's like we could see ourselves and there was a bigger context. When we talk about mental health, it's like, what is mental health and where are we? Is there a map for mental health? And I find this physical chart where we're talking about the window of tolerance. This is where everything is going well. We're able to actually roll with life's ups and downs. you know, something will come along and sort of spike our nervous system, but we can integrate it and come back into the zone of, right, of excellence, the optimal zone.
I'm sorry. So for the listeners that aren't watching this, the graph that Rebecca's showing kind of shows a window of like an optimal zone where I guess you can successfully, however you could subjectively describe that, manage like the ups and downs of our life situation, what we'd call stress or suffering or whatever. And then if you're out of that range too low, it's hypoarousal. So you might get numbness, it says, or no feelings or lack of energy. So I guess it's some dysregulation or dysfunction of this process. And then if it's, you know, too high and you can't manage that stress, you can get emotional overwhelm or panic, anxiety and such. I think we could probably all relate to that. You know, not long ago, or actually it was a while ago, we had Justin Sunseri on talking about the polyvagal theory, which kind of looks like just a different way, a very similar way to put those ideas on just like a, I guess like a parallel scaffolding, if you will, to like map, you know, how the nervous system is managing itself, responding to, you know, whatever sensory input that's coming in.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Stephen Porges' work on the polyvagal theory really opened up this whole world, kind of like stepping onto the yoga mat. It's like, oh, we can actually govern our own nervous system. So, you know, it's like, it's that shift between I'm at the influence of my nervous system, and it's driving me, and I'm sort of the skier behind the boat, versus now that we understand more about the vagus nerve, we are starting to learn that we can influence it. So like just in this moment, if I soften my eyes, because the 10th cranial nerve, which is the vagus nerve, wires in around the eyes, around the mouth, into the face, right at the base of the cranium. It's if I soften my eyes, that subtle anatomy, I'm actually sending a message down into my viscera and to the central nervous system that I'm safe, that everything is okay. So we can practice this subtle anatomy that then has a deep impact on how we're wired.
Right. You know, it's interesting you say that, because it's not just for ourselves, but, you know, we rely on to see other people's faces, which is an interesting topic over the last years, the hiding of faces and the idea of there being a cost, or some claim no cost to that hiding of the face with some kind of apparatus. And here we are in what's been, for many people, the most stressful year of their life, for, you know, obvious reasons. And we rely on seeing people's faces to regulate our nervous system from these subtle nuanced changes in like how they're holding their eyes or their mouth. And there's all these muscles of face. I remember listening, it was one of Gladwell's books, I forget, but it was describing like someone that worked for an FBI that was analyzing facial expressions, it kind of as like I think he was like kind of like a human lie detector, because there were some things that were so involuntary that you could pick up on, because there's, you know, all these little muscles we don't think of that move in all these different directions.
Yes.
And I guess there's patterns that we have when we're like lying or searching for a truth, or, and you could like pick up on them, but there's a lot that we're communicating non-vocally with each other that we're really relying on that information. And anybody could, I mean, if you think about this in an extreme form, it's very easy to wrap your head around. Like if somebody just had a super evil look on your face, you'd know you would have a response internally to that.
Yes.
And then if somebody was like, you know, arms open looking for a hug with a ear to ear grin, you'd have a different response. So obviously there's something to be said that we are affected by the expression of someone else. And we rely on that for signals of safety.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we call it co-regulation, right? And yeah. I mean, the truth is, like, we're biospiritual. We're biological beings, right? And some would say we're spiritual beings having a human experience. I think Teilhard de Chardin was the first one to kind of name that. But so we're neurobiologically wired for connection. We're mammals. We're warm-blooded. We're social. And there's been studies that say, you know, a straight face without expression actually triggers terror in the human nervous system. And we do rely on each other. So for that co-regulation to, because we're essentially pack animals. I mean, we need each other, you know, all of the sort of the Gallup, you know, figured out that human beings need 4 to 6 hours of human connection. And we would call it human engagement, to feel happy, to feel well. And Stephen Porges, what he found out.
Is that a day, 4 to 6 hours a day?
4 to 6 hours a day. And it can be in the modern world that can include, emailing and texting. Like I text, you know, one of the only ways my sister will connect is through texting. So thank goodness there's texting, right? So that counts, right? If we're like back and forth for 15 minutes, that's engagement.
Because you're thinking about someone else.
You're thinking of, yes, exactly. And in some level, you're seeing their face, even though you're looking at a screen that's just print, you know. But and another thing that's really helpful for the human nervous system is actually emojis. Interestingly enough, no right? Kidding. So, you know, like, so when someone does have that, you know, smiley face or a funny face, you get a hit from that, right? And so an emotional hit from that. So that actually does kind of take the level of engagement the next step further to add that expression, because we are emotional beings. Stephen Porges realized like human engagement is the thing that brings us back into our optimal zone. Mm. So I want to go back to what you said about alcohol as a companion, because I think at this stage in, I think in our modern world, anxiety and depression can feel like a companion for people. Anxiety is very compelling. You know, like the nature of the mind is to disperse, right? So like when we step on that yoga mat, like you were saying, that beautiful image of like going, shutting the door, looking your mat up and down, stepping. I know that feeling of like looking at my feet and I'm like, everything just sort of comes together. It's almost like you've got a sheet of paper and the filaments, like magnet filaments all over the sheet, and you put a magnet under and they all go, right? It's like body, breath, mind, suddenly all in one place. And that experience of focus and integration and synchronization between the body, the breath, and the mind, I think is one of the most nourishing experiences of being alive. And I asked myself, well, why is that? And I was trained in the Hakomi method of psychotherapy. And one of the things that we were taught over and over is healing happens in the present moment, right? I mean, our best experiences in life, when we do like a life review, it's like when we feel most alive and when we feel most aligned, lined up in this now moment.
Yeah, it's hard to... you know, I work in a gym as like the day job.
Yes.
And we always teach like breathing practices first. And, you know, one thing I find myself repeating over the years is it's kind of hard to be anxious or depressed and have your attention on your breath at the same time. So that act of bringing your awareness to your breathing and going inward.
Yes.
It's hard to be depressed in that moment because the act of the observation is really this portal into the present moment. It's the act of observing the right here, right now.
Yes.
And it's hard to be right here, right now, and somewhere else simultaneously.
Exactly. Exactly, Les. Couldn't agree more with you. And that I think more of that, you know, more of that is what's needed. You know, I actually created a yoga group for mental health clinics. So teaching people how to regulate their own nervous systems. And it's the greatest freedom, right? When we realize that we can actually influence and impact our own experience of well-being, the tools of that are in our hands. And one of the first things that I would teach people and what we would start with each group is breath per minute. So how many breaths, you know, it's like, I'm going to turn the timer on and we're all just going to count the breath. One inhale, one exhale is one breath. It's amazing for some people who are moving so quickly through their day, how stopping, pausing, and literally taking a minute out, is like a revolution, right? And it's wild how time and space expands. You know, is it true that we're co-creating with the universe? I think it is. I think it is true what they say. And so it's like when we take that minute to breathe, time and space literally expands, and that minute seems like it goes on forever. And then that, oh my gosh, there's this companion right here who is the thing. She is the thing that distinguishes me from being dead or alive. This breath, it's like everything. And then also when we count how many breaths per minute we're taking, folks who come in highly anxious, they're going to be between 14 and 17.
Whoa,
sometimes 21 breaths per minute. So, you know, you've got a clavicle breather there, you know, that person's in a state of hyperactivation, right? So
that's a lot of breaths.
So the antidote, right? Yeah.
So do you find that the act of observation alone will create change there? Like if somebody just practices counting without trying to intentionally change it, it will just naturally change it and they'll start to slow down.
Yes. Yes.
It's funny. Like with, I talk nutrition with some folks, and when folks come in and they're used to eating like, standard American diet-ish processed stuff, easy food, I always start out with like, don't change anything. Just start reading ingredients. Don't worry about anything. You don't have to do anything. Just read the ingredients.
Yes.
And I'm amazed that like the act of observation.
Yes.
Just bring their awareness. They start to change. Like you don't have to, they see a word they can't pronounce and then they think differently about this food. And so I wonder if just like counting, like, oh, I did 17 breaths in a minute. You know, the next day you try it, you know, there's something inside you that knows 17 is too much. Mm-hmm. So you do something to come up with a better answer with a lower number.
Yeah, I think you're right. That whole, you know, that awareness is the first step to mindfulness. And mindfulness really shifts the brain. I was reading, you've possibly heard this before, but I remember the first time I read this, where why is meditation so important? Why is mindfulness so significant to well-being? And the way the brain is myelinated, so the inner brain, the limbic brain, it was myelinated before the frontal cortex in human development in early childhood, right? So myelination increases the speed at which a synapse travels. Okay. So you've got the brain stem as like the wrist. And then if you fold your thumb, for your listeners who are just listening, if you fold your thumb into the middle of your palm, and then you wrap your four fingers over the thumb, this comes from Dan Siegel. this is an image of the brain. So you've got the brain stem is always bringing up sensation from the body in, and the myelination was that information goes most quickly into the limbic brain, which is the reptilian, which is the fight, flight, freeze part of the brain. And then the myelination of the prefrontal cortex came later. So when we slow down and count our breaths, or we step onto the yoga mat, or we sit down onto the meditation cushion, or we enter a space that's cultivated towards deliberateness, we're taking the stimulus, right? So the midbrain is going to receive information from the body more quickly. It's also going to receive stimulus from the senses more quickly. So things that we see, smell, hear, taste, and touch through the receptors in our skin. So when we sit down to meditate, we're actually reprogramming those pathways. So we're sitting on a meditation cushion and somebody in the back of the room, maybe we're in a meditation practice and someone in the back of the room drops their water bottle, poom, right? So this sound goes off in the room. If we're in a state of mindfulness, we're taking that sound in and we're observing it. And we're gonna allow that to kind of ripple through our awareness, breathing in, breathing out. And we'll pay attention to that. So we take stimulus over time. This is also why practice and repetition is so important, is because we're actually rewiring the pathways in our brain so that that stimulus starts to go more readily into the frontal cortex versus more immediately into the midbrain.
So then with practice of hearing a sound and kind of integrating that interpretation through different parts of the brain, you're training yourself to not freak out when you hear sounds.
You're training yourself to not freak out.
So yes. Then like a bigger sound comes, mm-hmm. A tree falls in the backyard or whatever, you hear a bang, a firework, a gun, and it's like you're not yes. necessarily tripping the wire because you're practicing integrating the cranial nerve that's bringing sound input
yes.
into that interpretation center.
Yes.
And into learning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
Into the higher executive functioning. So, right. And you think of like any human being who's like excellent at their craft, whether it's like a principal or a doctor, you know, or a top trainer at the gym, or an EMT person. It's like those people who stay somatically grounded, like they keep their feet on the ground. Something intense happens, but they're able to actually use their perception to accurately evaluate what's actually happening in the moment versus the story of what's happening in the moment.
Gotcha. Right? So is that what you refer to, Rebecca? Sorry to cut you off there. When you mentioned earlier, like mental fitness or hygiene, it's mm-hmm. like, it's the flexing of that muscle. It's the practice flexing the muscle of like really responding mm-hmm. instead of like reacting.
Yes, yes, yes. So mental fitness, I think that I'm in the process of writing a book about this. I talk about it as there's a body component, a breath component, and a belief component. Right. So do you want me to go into that?
Yeah, do your thing.
Okay. So the body component is know that you're wired, right? Which is this whole vagus nerve. It's the whole polyvagal piece. Like we get in our car in the morning and we're so not machines. And I think there's a way, and this is helpful. We get into the car in the morning and we turn the ignition on or press the button. We we are relying on the wiring of that car, but did we look under the hood to like check out like, hey, is everything connected? Is everything firing well? Like we just automatically assume that everything is good unless we get that little light, right? But we rely on it. We don't think about the wiring of the car. We just automatically rely on it. And I think it's similar with our bodies, is that we don't commonly, unless we're mindfulness, you know, tracking that specifically, we don't automatically think about our wiring.
There's no check engine light.
There's no check engine light except anxiety. Panic is a check engine light for sure. Depression, right? And so I think that's why tracking the nervous system is so helpful and so critical in mental health and tracking our own mental health. And so, you know that we're wired. Know that you're wired is the starting point where you're like, look at the ingredients of that, you know, particular product. It starts with awareness. Awareness is the gateway into mindfulness. And mindfulness is really the thing that is the companion, like the breath, that determines how we do our day. So know that you're wired, and then know how you're wired. So some of us are wired to go into states of hyperactivation more quickly, and some of us are wired to go hypo.
And would that be like comparing like fight or freeze?
Freeze can happen in hyper or hypo states.
Okay.
Freeze, when there's panic, we can freeze, right?
So it's not necessarily okay.
It's not necessarily.
You can go fight, flight, freeze in either of those directions.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. Yep.
So the ventral vagal state of the nervous system is when we're in the optimal zone, when we're sailing our little boat in the water and we can go with the waves, the wind, all of that, kind of stay on course no matter what comes our way. Sympathetic is related to the fight flight. So it's more related to the limbic brain, right? And it's really, my understanding is, when we have enough human engagement and it's healthy human engagement, we're going to stay in our optimal zone in a way better way. When we are not getting our social engagement needs met, then we'll start to most commonly go into a state of hyperactivation. And I actually think of things as like gossiping even is a sign, is a mild sign that we're feeling disconnected. And so it's almost like gossip is an unhealthy way to try and reconnect.
Interesting.
It's kind of unconscious, right? But it's the beginning of a fight, gossip, right? Wow. So, right? So it's interesting how subtle these things can get. And really when someone is fighting or all the way up into a rage, you gotta know that if you look into that person's nervous system, they're really longing for connection and soothing. But it's an unhealthy strategy to get an engagement need met, a social engagement need met.
That makes sense. That's cool.
And then if that doesn't work, what we'll do is we'll kind of evolutionarily slide back towards a more primitive form of engagement, which we call the dorsal ventral, which is the fold, freeze, feign death, which we associate with depression. If you think about it from a social engagement perspective, it's like, I tried all these things to connect or to relate or to feel included, and they didn't work. And so I'm going to collapse in on myself. And in each of these these three kind of categories of the optimal zone, hyperactivated or hypoactivated, it's obviously more complex than that, but that door sliding down to dorsal, it's the most primitive response in the nervous system is to feign death. And the belief there is I don't exist and the world doesn't exist. And we see this a lot in teenagers, right? Young people, and not just young people, but we're seeing, I think we're in the middle of the biggest mental health crisis in human history. And, you know, I think we see a lot of young people in these states of collapse. And what that, if we look through the lens of the nervous system at what is that human being needing, well, they're needing connection. Usually they're needing movement, so stimulus into the nervous system. They're needing their cup to be filled.
Right. Do you think social media plays a big role in that, that more and more people will go inward and feel maybe unseen or unconnected, even though it's a version of connection?
Facebook will never replace face-to-face time, right?
Because yeah, they're growing up with this.
Right.
This type of like sensory input in high doses, day in and day out, which could make you feel like you're just one in a, you know, there's a bajillion people out there and you're,
yes,
because you see how many is out there, as opposed to like when we grow up, you know, you saw the 20 kids in your class and you knew your grade had another 100 kids maybe. And it was like, you didn't see a whole lot more, but now they see there's like a sea of people. And it's like, how could I be seen? How it can make you feel small relatively.
Well,
maybe just thinking out loud.
Absolutely. Well, I think you're, you know, in a functional cosmology, we have a functional human culture. And in a functional human culture, we have a functional public health. And in a functional public health, we have functional individuals. So I think largely what you're speaking to is like, human beings cannot be replaced with machines or screens. And when human beings relate more to a screen or a machine than other human beings, we're not co-regulating, you know? So people need people. Right. we need each other to be sane. We need it for sanity's sake. And so I think what you're speaking to is a massive breakdown of social emotional needs. Like, you know.
So is that why I noticed you offer like retreat style healing?
Yes.
So is the idea of that to tap into that, I guess, tribal nature, like the group needs that we have? Is that more successful for people to go through like healing processes in a group together as opposed to one-on-one or by themselves, obviously?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a place for one-on-one work. And I do a lot of that with people. When we work in a group, absolutely, people realize they're not alone. That's the biggest thing. I think that's number one, is to realize you're not alone. Shared humanity is a huge part of, we need to know that we're connected, and to see other people struggling, you know, actually helps us feel better. To realize that we're not alone, we're not experiencing something that someone in the past hasn't experienced, you know, that kind of understanding that this is actually normal in the human condition, and normal in the face of abnormal situations, right? This is a normal response to an unprecedented kind of experience. So people need that comfort. It takes the stress level down so that then you can just be with your experience. And in groups, there is a collective learning. That's why we learn in groups. The human brain is, again, wired towards engagement. We're neurobiologically wired to connect. So it actually is a function of learning as well. And so, yeah, when people feel less alone, then the stress level goes down enough to be able to tolerate what they're going through more easily.
Gotcha. I have some questions. So I want to get like the 101 lesson of EMDR,
sure,
but I want to ask one other thing first. You alluded to a word earlier, and I've heard this word thrown around over the years, but I don't know if I've really got clarity of what it means, but the word somatic. What is that? How would you describe what that is referring to?
Sure. Well, so it comes from the word soma, which means body. And the biologists tell us that, cellular biologists tell us that our cells are either turned on or they're turned off. It's not totally my wheelhouse. So, someone else would have to explain that more. But my experience of it is embodiment practice. So going out for a walk, doing yoga, martial arts, Tai Chi, the more that we move in our bodies, especially when we're paying attention to what we're doing, right? So we're synchronizing the body and the mind, more and more of that cellularity turns on, right? So like I just got a bed of nails, right? I was listening to Tim Ferriss. He was talking about the bed of nails. It's this acupuncture mat, right? Do you know it?
Oh, okay. I have a similar one. Yeah.
Right? The acupuncture mat. So you stand on that thing and it's like, ooh, right? Your whole everything, your whole physiology just lights up, but also your brain lights up.
Oh, so you stand on it. I have one that you lay down on your back with it.
Yeah, you can do that, but you can also just stand.
I've never considered standing on it.
Consider it.
Well, I know what I'm doing after this interview.
Right? Exactly. And then pay attention. I mean, that's the best thing about having awareness is that we get to, it's like a lighthouse where we're putting that light, you know, determines what we see. So we get to turn that and then pay attention to how that impacts you. So there's, in my experience, the more embodied I am, the more awake I feel, the more alert, right? So somatic is turning those cells on, having practices that turn your cells on and then turn your brain on. So in EMDR, we do bilateral stimulation. We actually stimulate the right and left hemisphere of the brain and we get them to have a conversation, you know, so that back and forth is happening. And then we're starting to play with a full deck.
So bilateral stimulation. So is that with eye movements?
Yeah. So EMDR 101.
So let's get into this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet. Okay. So to talk about EMDR, let's first quickly, briefly talk about trauma. Trauma is either developmental or sort of more circumstantial. So developmental trauma would be things that happen in early childhood that happen repeatedly, and we create something called core beliefs. Those core beliefs get determined usually between the age of, 3 and 5. So we actually have life experience and we make up stories about what those life experiences mean, but we make them up before the neocortex has even developed. So we don't actually know we've done it. So it feels, it's like, that's why there's just this automatic sort of, we call it, unconscious until it's conscious. So usually, right? So I'm not enough, or the world isn't safe, right? So core beliefs, and then our physiology also wires in with the people we grow up with. So if we grow up with a particularly anxious mother, we're gonna most likely, have a little more proclivity towards anxiety. There's a lot that goes into that. That would be probably for another time, but, so there's how we're wired, and then there's the beliefs, the core beliefs in there.
So you said 3 to 5. Is that's like a sweet spot? What I've heard, I've heard stories of people being traumatized, like even at birth, like being born with the cord wrapped around their neck. Like, do you think even something like that, where it's a really stressful, 10 minutes, whatever it is, till they cut the thing off, like, can that trigger something that develops into a belief?
Oh my gosh. Age. Yes. It's actually, from being in the uterus to about five up to seven. So from some people even say from conception, right? So, but things that are happening while you're growing in your mama's belly, absolutely. Those things are imprinting into your nervous system. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
My mother said that when she was pregnant, she would, eat ice cream to calm the baby down, the cold bowl sitting on her belly. I wonder what a fetus thinks about that, how that affects, like, why is this lady freezing me out?
Interesting. And what went through my mind was the sugar, right?
So obviously.
Right?
Well, then that generation, they didn't know much about nutrition and its relationship to physiology.
Yes, exactly.
But three to five, that really resonates with me because that's the age I was when I remember seeing my dad with a suitcase walking out of the house and not understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
And I remember, and it really wasn't until I quit drinking until memories started coming up of witnessing that and being able to see myself there, like as an adult kind of watching, look at that little 4-year-old boy on the doorstep, not understanding why his father's leaving with a suitcase. Mm-hmm. And then like now I know, cause I've done a lot of work and I think I still have a good amount of work to do. And it really manifests in my relationship with him. Like, I can have an argument with my mother and like the second the phone call ends, there's like nothing lingering. Like there's no doubt in my mind. She loves me unconditionally. I love her. Like we disagree all the time and it doesn't really matter. The relationship seems to be impenetrable in some way. And then like, if I have a fight with my father, it's like, it's a crazy type of stress that goes on for a long time and takes a lot of work to address. But the belief system is very interesting because it wasn't until, you know, I quit drinking where I could look at that and say, oh, I could see that him leaving made me think, not consciously, like you said, because your prefrontal cortex isn't developed.
Correct.
But the subconscious is like, I'm not worthy of his love. I'm not worthy of him sticking around. I'm not worthy. Mm-hmm. And then like that belief gets built in and then it could show up and be manifested in all other aspects of your life. And then in your behaviors, like if you don't think you're worthy of, you're good enough for whatever, good health, whatever, like you'll find reasons to, you know, make your life worse so that you kind of get what you are worthy of.
Yeah,
what your subconscious thinks you're worthy of, which is not enough.
Yes, we're wired to win. We're wired to win. So if we're letting our core belief drive the bus, then that's what's going to win. What the belief that's driving the bus is going to win the day. Right? We're wired to win. So
that's interesting.
Right?
Find a way to win, even though dysfunctional progress or growth or health.
Yep.
Wow. So so EMDR stands for eye movement
eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Yep. So.
And this is because the eyes somehow have like just a direct line into this part of the brain.
Yes. So fascinatingly, right? So the ocular nerves wire into the hemispheres of the brain. So the right eye, they crisscross, which is part of the reason the eye movement is so essential, because we actually want to get, so the part of the brain that links the right and left hemispheres called the corpus callosum. And we actually want to get a lot of activity. We want to really massage that part of the brain and get it lit up and get those pathways open and running. So, because we want the conversation to happen and be equally distributed between the two hemispheres. So EMDR 101 is like, okay, we want the two hemispheres of the brain to play tennis. When we have had a traumatic experience, the right hemisphere tends to get overly engaged. The right hemisphere is connected more with emotions. It's also connected more with negative thoughts. And it's kind of more of the artist brain. Sorry to link negative thoughts and artist brain. That's those aren't necessarily connected, but it's kind of the storyteller, right? In the sense, in that sense. The left brain is the quote unquote rational brain. It's more of the scientist. It's the more of the one that makes sense of things and puts the pieces together. The right hemisphere could take a little snippet of experience and make this huge story about it. So we actually want to link that capacity with what actually happened, with the more kind of regulated, measured understanding the left hemisphere, which the left hemisphere brings. The left hemisphere is also more connected to positive mental states. So what we're doing with EMDR and the eye movement, or rather the bilateral movement, talk about that in a sec, is to actually get the two hemispheres of the brain to play tennis. When we're in trauma, it's like the right hemisphere is up against a wall going bloop, bloop. And that ball is like, it's just a loop. It creates like a cognitive loop. We have common thoughts that just sort of keep, you know, looping, or sensations, experiences, or triggers, right? We go instantly into a shutdown or a fight trigger response. What with EMDR is we slow things down and we actually go right. Once I get, like, there's five to seven pieces of information I need to know about your history. And then in order to process a memory, so we do, what did you make that mean? The dad left the suitcase. What did you make it mean about you? You know, it's probably, what would you say?
Oh, in that case, I think looking back, I meant that to mean I'm on some level, either I'm not good enough or I'm not worthy of his love. Like, yeah. If I was worthy, then he'd stick around, kind of.
Exactly.
Thing.
Yep. Exactly. And that's the other thing.
And now, doing. Like, I know it wasn't about me at all, but yeah, at four years old, you don't know it's not about you.
At 4 years old, you're completely self-referencing. Everything's about you at that age, right? I mean, it just is. And so that's another reason all these things kind of slip into the city of core beliefs without our even knowing it. We can't help it. We're a sponge. And so I'm not worthy of love. What would you prefer to believe? There's our North Star. Hmm. Right? What would you prefer to believe?
I guess that I am worthy of of love, unconditional love. Yeah.
And when you think of that image of seeing your dad with the suitcase and that thought, I am worthy of love, how true does that feel in this moment, right? Zero.
It feels good to say that. It's interesting. I probably should say that out loud more, because I'm not prompted like that. Mm-hmm. Like you just prompted me, and it's a reminder of like the value of an affirmation or something, like, oh, saying these things out loud, like I could feel my chemistry in my body change for the better.
Beautiful.
Just by saying that.
Yes. Beautiful. So you made your way over to the left brain.
Okay. So I took, emotional, deep embedded emotional thing, and I applied like kind of like a logical thinking to it from the left brain to reshape it positively.
Like positively, an affirmation.
Okay.
Yeah, a preferred cognition.
So you have, the first thing is the belief that you, what belief did you have? The second thing is the North Star. What belief do you want to have? And then what's next?
Yeah. And then when you think of the image of your dad with the suitcase and the thought, I'm not worthy of love, what emotion comes up?
That's a tough one. What emotion? I don't know. Give me a list of options. What are emotions?
Confusion.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. That, you know, you're right. Fear. I remember confused. Like I didn't understand what was, didn't make sense.
Perplexing. Yeah.
Confusion is a good one. Yeah.
And then where, and then how bad is it now? Which is a huge, this is one of the ways we measure in EMDR, is like, not how bad was it then, but how distressing is it to you now, 0 to 10, when you make yourself think of it?
When I think of like being back then, or as
right in this moment, as you touch that confusion, 0, no distress, 10, the most you've ever felt, what do you get right now?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me now. I'm not confused about why. Because now I know, like, this was his shit, or the shit between him and my mother. And that was like a toxic relationship.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't make it toxic. That's made it.
Yeah.
You know, they were showing up in the world the only way they knew how, and they had shitty tool set to work with each other.
Right.
So, like, yeah, I don't get confused. When I think of, yeah, it doesn't bother me at all.
Okay, good. So, and usually people have like 2 or 3 emotions that an experience like that will regularly trigger or even subtly, right? So, yeah, so we would access that emotion. How intense is it now, and where do you feel it in your body? So you can see that from that, Les, we're accessing memory, right? Mm-hmm. With that image, we're accessing the cognitive aspect, because human beings are meaning-making beings. So we have an experience, we make a meaning of it. We want to know what that meaning is, because that's where we're getting like, we get pulled in. That's the unconscious kind of loop that, like you said, can color one's whole life, right? So really, really important. And what would you prefer to believe? The North Star. And then we can see we're accessing emotion and where it lives in the body. So that's what I love about EMDR, is that we're actually getting at all the different aspects of how we're wired and who and how we be as beings. We would then, and there's a lot of prep work, and you know, we don't really suggest people do this on their own. However, there's practices that you can do on your own. But then once I've given you enough tools, so there's an on-ramp to EMDR therapy. There's tools that you would get that I teach you. And then if that was, you know, one of them, we start with that memory. We engage the eye movement so that, kind of in a very sort of easy, simple way to put it, because my understanding is still evolving of exactly how this works, but we're getting the emotional brain and the rational brain to talk to each other. We're getting them to play tennis so that the ball goes over the net, the corpus callosum, into the rational brain's court, and then the rational brain throws it back over the net. Like, oh, but do you remember? So one of my first times practicing this, when I was training in EMDR, I worked with a fellow clinician because we're all clinicians in this EMDR training. And he offered a memory from when he was 9, and his mom made him do like tuba practice at this church after school. And he was super ticked off about it still at 40 something years old. And he had this longing to be a musician, but he had this huge somatic, physical, visceral response of aversion to seeing any musical sheets or instruments, or even contemplating hiring a teacher. So this is how we get stuck, is we have this longing. Right? He had this longing towards wind instruments, even at 42 years old. But at the same time, he had this like gas pedal, but then he had this brake pedal at the same time, right? That's how we get stuck, right? And so, and I think it interrupts a lot of human genius, this thing, right? So this is part of my passion, is where do you want to head? So we get in there into this memory, and his emotional brain is like, I'm pissed at my mom. Every time I look at music sheets, I want to vomit. Like, I have this visceral response, and I keep putting down my longing to study. Okay, we get in there. We start. So that's the emotional brain. We throw the tennis ball over to the rational brain. You know, it takes a little time to get warmed up. We get warmed up, and he's like, oh my God, I totally forgot. My dad died like the year before. Not that I forgot my dad died, but I'm just remembering
the relationship. Here
it is. Here it rolls out. My poor mom is suddenly a single parent and she needs somewhere for me to go after school because she's working. So she picks this church down the street from our house so that the bus can drop me off at my house. I can walk to go have this lesson. And when I'm done, she's home from work and we have dinner. He like, see that? See how getting the ball to go over the net into the rational brain? He's like, I completely forgot about that. And now that I'm 42 and I have more myelination in my brain for one thing, I mean, and lots of lived experience, he could pull from what actually happened.
That's cool.
He could pull from the what was actually going on in her world and in life at that moment. And here's what happens, Les, that I see all the time, which I have goosebumps right now, is the sort of spiritual aspect, or I don't know what you want to call it, but the sacred aspect of life comes online. All of a sudden, here's this 42-year-old man who's such a lovely person and has been so hung up about this on multiple levels. And all of a sudden he's now in a state of compassion.
Yeah. That's the word that was coming to me. You could start to see, you could start to ask like, what is it like for that person? What? And then it's like, you know, anger could just dissipate or fear, you know, whatever fear is coming from that. That's interesting.
So the bilateral work, when we're in person, we would do eye movement. That's the modality that's been researched the most since COVID. I've been working online with people using sound.
Oh, cool.
You can even, they'll even shut their eyes. You can see their eyes moving, right? So there's bilateral music that has been created for this work that it also triggers, you know, the brain.
You mean where the sound's going from back and forth from the right ear to the left ear?
Correct. It's like usually happening in both ears, but then there's a layer of the sound that's toggling back and forth.
Oh, interesting.
You can also, you know, there's a butterfly hug. You can tap the, so if I tap the left side of my body, my right hemisphere is getting pinged. Light up, light up, light up. Hmm. Engage.
It's interesting. We had a nutritionist on recently, Mary Ruddock, and she gave me like a bunch of homework and I was surprised. It was very comprehensive, like package. She said, you know, do this, don't do that. And in it, it was like limbic brain training section. It was like, and she was telling me to do things with my non-dominant hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been like looking for things to do, like I'll do like sometimes dry brushing and I realize I'm always using my dominant. So, and I feel really awkward, especially at first. I'm getting better using the other, but there's something soothing about it, or brushing my teeth with my non-dominant hand, or like I'll skateboard with my son.
Mm.
And for those that aren't familiar, when you skateboard, you have like your, whatever the direction that feels comfortable. So most people will skate with the right foot in the back. There's some that skate like Goofy, which is the other. Yes. But when you go opposite to what they call it switch.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm terrible. I'm a terrible skateboarder in general. Almost 44 years old. But when I skate switch, it's very hard for me to just even stay on the board. It takes like every bit of concentration, but there's something about it that's like calming when I'm done. I'm not calm when I'm on the board. But I think it's related to this, like switching to different sides of the brain. So how do, so what's an example of, so first you do like the you go through the talk part of this process to identify, you know, what's underneath the rug, kind of what's goal
over the trauma wall.
And then you move into like application of using your senses to help facilitate this, like with, you know, whether it's the tapping, the ear, the sounds you're talking about, or the eye movements. Like what's an example of the eye movements that you use to help facilitate the healing or the process.
What's an example of the eye movement? Like,
yeah,
it's pretty straightforward. Yeah. So if we were in person, I would literally move my fingers across. It's sort of like a windshield wiper.
Okay. But, so you're just making your eyes go back and forth. Kind of like you're watching that tennis game.
And that's how Francine Shapiro discovered EMDR in the 80s. She was walking down the beach on the western coast of the US. She's passed on now, but she's brilliant person, and she was processing something from her day, and she was looking to the right and looking to the left, and she realized over time that she started to feel better, and she was like, what did I just do? Right, there's reflection for you. She went up into her neocortex, right? Like, what did I just do? Oh, I remember looking to the right and looking to the left and kind of going back and forth. And so she had a dear friend who was linked to some local university, and they set up a trial experiment. Like, hey, she actually went home. I think she was living in a community house. She told some of her friends, like, hey, can you try this? And they were like, yeah, I see what you're talking about. Like, something's shifting here, right? It's literally digesting. We're literally digesting input. And when there's stress in a human life, one of the first casualties is sleep. And our basically EMDR on one level is mimicking REM sleep.
The rapid eye movement.
So that's when in my business, I say I partner with nature. That's what I mean. It's like our nervous systems are designed to process and digest daily stimulus. Now we live in the 21st century. So daily stimulus, we're not at human speed, to quote Laura Brazil, right? Mm. Right. Human speed. We are not at human speed right now. We're at machine speed. And so we are constantly barraged with stimulus. So overstimulation is another way to talk about anxiety, right? There's too much going on. So, and then throw that overstimulation in with being super sedentary, and the body is freaking out. Like, what do I do with all this stuff? That's why movement, mindfulness, that's why I'm so psyched to be talking to you, right? Like, it's like that, that's why these things are our allies in as an antidote to all of the 21st century stimulus that we're being asked to kind of figure out how to work with on a moment-to-moment daily basis. When we sleep, you know, so I think REM sleep even isn't enough to handle all of that. That's why movement is so important.
Well, nobody gets enough of it. So,
and nobody gets enough of it. And it's the first casualty that goes when we're stressed. And it is the nervous system's natural way of literally digesting stimulus and input, or we could say experience. There's like texts, phone calls. And then if you've got like a recent loss, like a spouse dies or a child passes, or, you're in a job that every Monday morning you don't like your work culture. And then all of a sudden you go from your life to a context where there's a stress that, you know, just really turns you off or jacks you up, right? So then you add those layers, and then it's really hard to digest, right?
Right.
So EMDR, I see it as a way of hitting the reset button on the nervous system so that individual can start reprocessing. So we desensitize the stress around a particular experience. So then we reprocess it. We go back in there. We, you know, like with the example of the colleague I was working with, mm-hmm. you know, in the music lessons, like he went back in there and he he was like, oh, he suddenly had compassion for the music teacher. Like, oh, he was doing the best he could. I was a 9-year-old kid who didn't really want to play the tuba. And he had, you know, he stood reprocessing to me is like you stand in a different relationship to that memory now. It's not like it gets erased. That memory is still there, but it's not triggering the hyper-hypo anxiety pattern.
It's really, like, you're altering your relationship with yourself.
And with history, which is profound. I mean, that just blows my mind. Like, you know, Bessel van der Kolk, the body keeps the score.
Right.
We start in EMDR. Well, what scores do we have here? We take an inventory. What's over that trauma loss list? What number you got? 0 to 10 on those. You know, what's bugging you the most? And we can actually, in present time, go back in time with one foot. And we call it dual state awareness. There's one foot in the present moment. So we're resourced at least enough. You know, we got to be resourced enough. And one foot in the past. And it's like, again, we're toggling. I always talk about it as like, okay, your current self, you know, you know, now you're a dad, I think, right? You mentioned your son, you know, you can, you know, and you're 44, you got all of these skills and tools that you didn't have when you were that 4-year-old. And you actually, while the bilateral work is going on in your brain, you actually get to pass some of that nutrient back, some of those resources back to that little one. We call it corrective experience. And I think this is a fascinating thing, you know, in the human brain and nervous system is like we can, and our beings, we can actually go back and make up some of that difference. And
you, do you mean like, see, like in my case, like visualizing my 4-year-old self, the inner child, whatever, and like communicating, like this is like, this isn't about you. Like I have one foot here with today's resources. Like today's ability to interpret what actually happened and try to convey that to that inner child in a way.
The one thing I want to say about this, Les, is that we can't think our way to health, right? So yes, like affirmations and visualizations help. And when we engage at the level of the nervous system, so with in addition to the bilateral work. So after 20 minutes of working, the brain becomes even more receptive. You start to, time and space starts to shift when you're inside of an EMDR session. So it's kind of like you enter a slightly altered state. It's from within that state you're able to then give something to that one who wasn't given what they were needed at the time.
Gotcha. So and it sounds like like kind of like hypnosis. You're going to a
I don't
altered
know.
State or
yeah. No. I mean, it's that's not really my wheelhouse. It is different. It is different.
I guess there's a lot of ways to slip into an altered state of consciousness where you could reframe things or take different approaches.
Yes. And it's from inside of that memory. So it's like in a therapeutic session when we get inside of that memory and you're not there alone. Part of the reason something is traumatic is that it was too much too soon or too fast. And there wasn't the support to give what was needed at the time. Right. From like, there wasn't, you know, if, there was something more that was needed that wasn't given from the environment. And so we're able to have a do-over.
Gotcha.
And the brain then catches up, right? So some part of the brain doesn't know, was that then or is that now? Right? And so what happens is that then actually all the limbic firing around that early childhood memory gets freed up. It actually gets desensitized so that neurophysiological pathway, kind of, it's like that extension is no longer available, you know, sort of, right?
Right.
And so the, all the energy it takes to manage that, like you said, when so bravely, when you stopped drinking, that memory came up, right? It's like so painful, you know, that there's a healthy impulse in wanting to numb.
Right.
And so
it wasn't painful. It was more like, oh, look what I was soothing. I didn't even realize I knew I was soothing that.
Exactly. And that, so it takes that, you know, can take that sobriety to allow that to come up. And then it's in your conscious awareness. Then you actually can work with it directly, right? You can actually turn and face that and integrate it. Something about how it happened or the way it happened was too much to integrate in the moment. The things we integrate in the moment, we don't even remember, or we remember with a neutrality, or we remember with a positivity, right? But if there's something still hanging on, it's just not yet integrated. But that's the most amazing thing about this practice, is that we can actually do that now.
That's awesome.
And then, like, next time your dad calls, you'll be like, whoa, hey, oh my gosh. I mean, it's wild. Like the way something can go from like hot and fiery to like, that just really doesn't hook me anymore. And it's somatic. It happens on the level of the body.
Like, and all the cells are listening to all this.
If we're lucky, yeah. If, you know, if we have a good therapeutic relationship, that's a huge part of it. You know, there's enough safety in a person's life in the moment, you know, and that there's, we AIP, we tap into the healthy neural network that's already there. We tap into the health that's already there. And then we bring that thing that was sort of an estranged memory or an unintegrated experience, and we get to bring that into that healthy network. It's now integrated into the healthy network of our neurology. And so it just doesn't play out anymore.
That is exciting, I think, as someone that tries to, I guess, inspire people. I mean, we say this a lot on this channel, but try to empower people to play a bigger role in their well-being. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we have all these tools to choose from, and maybe there's more than one tool you could use for a given thing, but it's nice to have tools. And then as you practice, you sharpen those tools. And this sounds like a really cool, useful tool that we could tap into. And I think everybody has some shit from their past to deal with. Like, we all have our own type of suffering, trauma, and it's all real. And, you know, some people, I guess, will talk about how one sounds subjectively worse than another. Mm-hmm. But really, you know, everybody's biggest trauma is their biggest trauma, even if it might sound really kind of like a first world problem to some people. Mm. Like, to that person, that's their biggest trauma. So your biggest trauma is the 100% level for you. And it could be, you know, a wide range of things. It could just, you know, having this real low level of stress that happened over time, or it could be, you know, something very acute that happened.
Absolutely.
That's great. I want to thank you so much. I did not expect to talk about some of my own stuff on this, but I'm glad it did. It felt good. And I appreciate you, Rebecca, for walking me through that. That was unexpected. And these are things that I have talked about with Sarah before, and therapist to some degree, and really myself a lot, you know, through meditation and breath work, and sometimes even with some added helpers in as far as compounds that kind of help me along with that.
Sure.
And it's a little terrifying to say this when I know listeners are going to hear, but it feels good. So I thank you for that. I think that practice of vulnerability is very healthy, and we need more of it in the world. So I'm glad to play my role in that. And I'm grateful that you kind of in a very peaceful way dragged that out of me. That was painless. If people want to learn more about working with you one-on-one or your retreats or what you have to offer, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Sure. Thanks for asking, Les. StrongSolutionsBoulder.com.
StrongSolutionsBoulder.com. And we will link to that in the show notes.
Great. I appreciate that. And thank you so much for your courage. I think that's the biggest thing, like for any of your listeners who are listening to this, like there is effective, efficient support. You know, we really do get to kind of put down those things that and you're right, everyone has them. And there's an individual component and there's a collective component, right? So we don't have to suffer, right? We don't have to keep suffering. But it does take being vulnerable and saying, hey, this is going on. There's a quote that I love that's anonymous. We cannot be human alone. Right. So it's like when we reach out and say, hey, I'm struggling with this. Can you help? You know, and to persevere until you find love, right? You find a context where there's love, because in love, when there's love, we can learn because we feel safe. And that safety lets our guard down enough to go in there and really look at what's going on and to be honest with ourselves, like this thing is hanging me up. And okay, and I'm ready. I'm safe enough. I'm ready. Let's work this through. And I can actually get beyond it. We can actually stand on the ground of health again, because we're designed for that individually and collectively. So, yeah.
Great.
I welcome people to Boulder to come do an intensive with me. And
I would like to do that one time. It's one place that I haven't been that I just know I would love from what I hear. It just sounds beautiful, and it sounds like it goes a little bit more at human speed.
Yes,
there than where I live. So my daughter is going off to college in a couple months, and I think we're going to look for opportunities to see a little bit more of the country, and that's definitely a spot that we would like to check out. So if we do, we will definitely stop by.
That's great, hello. Les. I'd love it. Yeah.
Well, Rebecca, thank you again, and for the listeners out there. Always grateful for your listening. I hope you got some value out of this episode, and just stay tuned for the next one. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.
Well, folks, thanks again for tuning in and listening to that conversation. I hope you got something out of that conversation. I know that I did. Rebecca was a delight to talk to. When I was talking to her, I felt like really that there was no one else going to listen, and it was just me and her in a room. And I guess that's what we look for when we're in relationship with somebody and talking face to face, even if it is through Zoom. I gotta tell you, just a reminder, saying the things I did today has been really good for me. So I would encourage the listeners maybe to look at your own life a little bit, maybe with some curiosity of what might be available for you if you are willing to not just look inward, but bring what's held inward more to the surface and put it out there so you could work through it and build a healthier relationship with yourself. And then let those benefits disperse and translate in other areas of your life. Thanks again for tuning in. And if you don't mind sharing the episode, if you think you know someone in your life that would also find value in it. And if you're looking for ways to support the Mindful Movement, then check out our membership program. It's getting some upgrades right around the corner. So we're excited about that. And you could join us. I think actually, if this is aired when I think it is, then the day after you're hearing this, maybe we will have one of our live membership events. So if you sign up today or in time, you could join this month's live event. They're a lot of fun. We get together essentially through Zoom with other Mindful Movement members around the world, and we hang out together and do the practice. You know, we do some some intention setting. Sarah usually does a reading. We'll do some light movement. We'll do some light breath work. And then we finish with a guided meditation by Sarah. I always feel good after those, and it's fun to know that others are joining along at the same time. So I encourage you to check it out. Thanks again. I hope you have a great day.